From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the journalist Nicholas Basbains asks a scholar an intriguing question. Would Leonardo da Vinci, arguably the most gifted, the most imaginative person who ever lived, would he have been the genius he was without paper? Basbains' new book is about paper, and not just the craft of it or the history of it, though that's in the book too. But he's interested in how the act of writing something down affects the process of creation or discovery or invention. We use paper to record our history, to express our love, even, he says, to establish our identity. Basbains is in Utah this week. He'll join us today to talk about paper, which he says is the tool that transformed the world. After the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book that takes a comprehensive look at paper, the journalist Nicholas Basbains points out how a few years ago an association of paper historians had come up with something like 20,000 commercial uses for paper in the world. In the book, he says when it comes to pure utility, it would be hard to imagine where we would be without paper. But his book goes beyond utility. In fact, much of it is concerned with the role of paper on the human intellect. Every manner of scientific inquiry, he writes, may begin with a nonverbal spark in the mind, but more often than not, the true realization of that perception comes when it gets written down on a piece of paper. Architecture, engineering, scientific inquiry, almost all of that began as tinkering in notebooks and sketchpads. The same can be said for great music and great plays and great ideas. They got their start visualized on a sheet of paper. The subtitle of Basbains' book explains what he's after, the everything of the 2000 history of paper. And today, we're going to get to as much as we can. The history, the craft, its role in creativity and invention, and of course, the future of paper in the digital age. This book is called On Paper, the Everything of Its 2000-Year History. And Nicholas Basbains is coming to Utah later this week. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. Nicholas Basbains is the author of 9 books, all of them about books and book culture in some way or another. And he's joining us today from a studio in Watertown, Massachusetts. Nicholas Basbains, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. And that's a fantastic opening, by the way. You really hit the nail on the head, in my view, as to what I really tried to accomplish with this book. So thank you for reading it so carefully, may I begin by saying.
Good. Well, thank you. I mentioned all of the titles or the reference to your books, how they're all in some way related to books. So why is that? Why have you spent a good part of your professional life exploring books?
I began life as a writer, writing about bibliomania, which pretty much described my own condition. I was a literary editor here in Massachusetts for 13 years, and I had a syndicated literary column. By the way, one of my very first and most valued customers was the Salt Lake Tribune, which took my column for many years,
right,
7 or 8 years while I was freelancing. So I'm delighted to be coming out to Salt Lake City, which was a very early supporter of my work as a literary journalist. But over a period of 20 years, I would estimate over 1,000 authors, and something I did from the very beginning was to get inscribed copies of these books. These were always personal interviews conducted either here in the Boston area or in New York, and so I became a bibliophile, not only just a book critic, but I was collecting books, and this passion led to the writing of my first book, A Gentle Madness, which had the subtitle Bibliophiles, Those Who Love Books, Bibliomanes, as in maniacs, and the eternal passion for books. I'm often asked, am I a bibliophile or a bibliomaniac? My wife says, well, he's on the cusp. He's certainly at risk. And so for this book, my editor, Vicki Wilson at Knopf, came up with the word bibliophiliac.
Right.
So we're kind of in the middle. But I guess that's a roundabout way of describing the process that led to this book on paper after having written a number of books about the passion to collect them, to possess them, to preserve them, a discursive discussion about the history of libraries and their future, about biblioclasm, the deliberate destruction of books. I had a book of my book on reading, Every Book Its Reader, which was to assemble a dream team of readers. It just seemed to make sense that I should take on the task of the stuff of transmission itself, which for more than 600 or 700 years here in the West, longer in the Middle East, and even longer than that in Asia where paper was invented, has been, in fact, paper.
Yeah.
And that really led to the creation of this book. It was an 8-year project. As you get to be my age, you'd think that after a while these books would take less time to do, not more. I spent more time on this book than I have on any of the previous 8. But here you have it,
yeah.
And I'm very proud of it.
What do you think it is? I want to sort of break this down as we go along. What is it about the process of writing something down that fuels the process of creativity, the process of invention, all of that? What is it about that, that it transfers something that is abstract into something quite literally tangible?
It's magical, and you ask creative geniuses where the process starts, which is why for that chapter that you have used, which you yourself have focused on in your introduction and again, where I discuss Leonardo da Vinci and Beethoven and Thomas Edison, so to take 3 disparate creative geniuses, but all who found expression really through transferring these images, these usually nonverbal images, from the mind's eye through the hand onto a sheet of paper. Where does that come from? I use for that chapter, and don't ask me to do it from memory, but it's a quotation from Shakespeare. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen gives them shape and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. I hope I didn't just really butcher it there. But Shakespeare is really talking about the creative process, where the ideas come from. He can't really say. He calls it airy nothing,
yeah,
giving shape and form to things unknown. And when you look at the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci, when you think about this quintessential creative genius, the archetypal Renaissance man, really we only have about 20 paintings which we can say are his. You know, the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper in Milan. None of his architecture really survives. None of his sculpture survives. What we really know about him are what he wrote down in these thousands of surviving notebooks, not just the writing and the mirror script, which was backwards, left-handed to boot, but the extraordinary illustrations, the progression of his mind, these cascading thoughts, which went strictly from his mind, his creative spirit, you know, through his hand onto a sheet of paper. And I asked Martin Kemp, you know, the world authority on Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks, who has really examined them all directly, not just facsimiles. Would it have been possible? It was a direct question. Would any of this have been possible, in your view, without paper? And he said, you know, I'd never thought of it quite like that. But no, it wouldn't have been. He said, this really is an example of a creative genius thinking on paper, where paper really not only is just a medium for the thought, but it's an instrument. It's a tool of the creative process.
I want to come back to that as we go, but let's back up a bit. What did you write about the fact that we were writing stuff down as humans on all kinds of different surfaces in our earlier history, stone and clay and cured animal skins and metal sheets and tree
bark. There you go.
Exactly. I mean, all kinds of stuff. So there's a long list of these surfaces that we've tried. What difference did it make that there was now paper?
Well, paper and papyrus, people tend to think that paper is the direct descendant of papyrus. Really, the only two things they have in common is the name. The word paper that we use derives from papyrus, and secondly, that they both derive from a vegetative source. But other than that, they are dissimilar. Papyrus can only be made from one plant, a marsh reed that grew abundantly in the Nile River and parts of Sicily and North Africa, other parts of North Africa. But paper is a compound, and paper can be made from any vegetative source, and as it indeed has. I mean, the great source for papermaking in the West for hundreds of years was rags, cotton and linen rags. But you can make paper from crushed walnuts. You can make it from seaweed. You can make it from virtually any kind of vegetative source. The point is the cellulose and hydrogen bonding, not to get too chemically involved in it. but what the Chinese perceived 2,000 years ago without actually articulating it chemically was this miracle of chemistry called hydrogen bonding, where the hydrogen and the oxygen atoms are contained in one chemical unit in cellulose, but you have to reduce it to fiber, suspend it in a lot of water, and pass it through a sieve, a screen, and those are the three elements to papermaking. Mm-hmm. It was there at the beginning, and it continues 2,000 years later. The vegetative fiber, water, and a screen mold. Papyrus was a lamination of strips that were pounded together. Yeah. So those two different things. But papyrus and paper, you know, coexisted for about 1,000 years.
Right.
One just didn't immediately displace the other. But the thing about paper is that it's abundant.
Yeah.
It's flexible. It's durable. You can make it anywhere. Once the rudiments are understood, it's very easy to master. And it just became so useful. Parchment, you know, we talk about parchment, which is from cured animal skins. Papermaking got to Germany in 1390. We know the date quite precisely, at the middle of Ullmannstromer. Well, within 60 years, Gutenberg was inventing the printing press. I don't think he would have invented the printing press to print on parchment, which is, again, cured animal skins. They estimate that the skins of 260 sheep would have been necessary or were necessary to print one Bible on parchment, because
wow.
He did print some Bibles on parchment. So paper was abundant, it was cheap, and you could do a lot of things with it. So I think that kind of partially answers your question, how it just became so powerfully important everywhere it went.
It's interesting how in the book you write about how we can kind of pinpoint when paper was invented, you know, AD 105,
That's the date that's the date the Chinese give, 105 AD, Tai Lung. But as a practical matter, in reality, it probably developed over several hundred years prior to that. Examples of earlier papermaking have been found, most notably by Sir Oral Stein, the great British archaeologist. He found specimens that date from about 100 BC or so. It was a process. What is so significant about Kai Lun is that he articulated. He's the first person to actually put it down on paper, so to speak, and presented it at court, at the imperial court. He formalized it, and so he is actually credited with inventing paper. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese, by the way, they cite paper as being one of their four outstanding inventions of antiquity.
Yeah.
So paper, printing, the other two are gunpowder and the magnetic compass. And if you see the Diamond Sutra in the British Library, which dates to 868 AD, that is a printed book, you know, which predates the Gutenberg Bible by, 500 years or so?
Right.
It's a woodblock. It's a carved woodblock, but it's printing on a sheet of handmade paper. So you have two of those marvels from antiquity in one example.
Mm. You went to you traveled to China, to the Yunnan province, where you found these ancient family paper operations. Talk about your travels there. This is a place where one particular mill you write about, a place that had been made, you know, where paper had been made by the same family for 6 centuries, I think it was.
600 years.
Yeah.
Astonishing as it may seem, a place called Jade Spring, it translates as Jade Spring. Well, it seems I'm a journalist who likes to go where the story is.
Yeah.
And as you have pointed out, the story begins in China. And if it turns out, as it does, that there still are places in China where paper continues to be made in much the same way as it was when it was invented 2,000 years ago, well, why not go and take a look? Certainly you aren't going to devote your whole book to that. And in fact, I only give part of one chapter, in fact, to papermaking in China. But it just seemed like the correct thing to do. And there was a small group of paper historians, international group, that they were making a trip, and they were going to go and try and find a number of these studios. And we found about 20 of them in Yunnan and Sichuan provinces. We spent 3 weeks there. And I hate to tell you how many years ago this was, 2007, when I made that trip. But I was allowed to tag along with them, and we had an excellent Chinese scientist and botanist who served as our guide, spoke perfect English, and he, in fact, as a member of the Chinese Academy of Sciences and a renowned botanist, wanted to see for himself examples of where paper was continuing to be made in this manner, because it is a vanishing handicraft. I mean, the vast volume of paper produced for the Chinese and by the Chinese is done mechanically in the modern way, but there are still a number of these shops where they make paper commercially by hand in the traditional way, and it just made sense for me to go and kind of experience some of this to get the book off on the right foot, so to speak.
Yeah, it's interesting how you write about how you found a lot of these operations high on mountainsides for some reason, maybe just the
way
it
high on
out.
Mountainsides and or down a bank. There's one cute story where, in fact, the woman who was leading this tour, a woman by the name of Elaine Koretsky, who's been doing this for 40 or 50 years, her role in life, it seems, is to find and document these hand papermaking operations. But she always led the way. And in one instance, it had rained heavily in the morning, and she was headed down towards the banks of the Yangtze River. She kind of got lost. There were no markers. A papermaker came up, carried her piggyback down the hill. I took a photo of her. And as soon as I did that, I fell on my back and slid all the way down to the banks of the river, thankfully not into it. But why were we going down the hill or up the hill? Because that's where the water is, again. And not only water in abundance, but of a certain purity. The purer the water, the better the paper. So you mentioned up the hill, down the hill, wherever the water is, basically, is where you will find these mills.
After it was invented, it traveled, you say in the book, in two directions, basically, westward through Central Asia toward Europe.
You mean the migration, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love the whole idea of this migration. I mean, the book is structured, for me, in three parts. I don't name them, but they're and I think you kind of touched on it. I mean, but the first section really details very selectively. I mean, I really do want to make clear that this is not an exhaustive history of paper. It's very selective. But I did want to give a sense of the migration, and the migration which travels eastward through Korea and into Japan, which gets an entire chapter to itself, and then west along the old Silk Road through Central Asia, where in 751 AD, another date precisely, by the way, the dating is really makes this so much fun, too. Yeah. You can really follow the migration. You know, we talk about the domino effect, which we've used in other historical contexts. But you can really follow the progression of paper, one country after another, where it was taken up, where it was taught, and where it just proceeded, and you can measure it. It's palpable how it transformed the culture of these places. But it moved eastward, as I mentioned, along the Silk Road, 751, the Battle of the Talas River, the only time in recorded history where the Chinese and the Arab world were involved in a territorial war. It turned out that the Abbasid Caliphate was victorious, and as a spoil of war, they took some Chinese prisoners who, in return for their lives, are said to have taught the Arabs papermaking. And instantly, you had these papermakers. I mean, you can date it. Samarkand is where this happened, and that became a center of papermaking, and the whole Islamic world really became the center of papermaking, and it's really another 400 or 500 years before it goes into Europe.
Yeah,
carried by them, in fact.
What's interesting about that, is, of course, is it becomes also a center of intellectual energy. I mean, because with one comes the other in the trajectory.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a coincidence. And it has been said, you know, that paper, when it gets to Europe, can really be credited partially with the Renaissance that takes place there. Because I gave you the timeline earlier. Paper comes in. It justifies the invention of the printing press with movable metal type by Gutenberg. And another thing the Arabs really introduced, they're credited with introducing, is this whole concept, and you alluded it to yourself earlier, this idea of notation. You know, it's just secondhand for us to have an idea and to doodle and scribble ideas down. But you really couldn't do that before you had paper. If I'm correct in this, the idea of being able to really formulate ideas in a kind of casual back of the envelope cocktail napkin matchbook sort of way, you know, that you really have this proliferation, this plenitude of paper that allows you to do this sort of intellectual activity. You see it really in architecture. You see it in engineering. I maintain that the Industrial Revolution is impossible without paperware. I mean, how otherwise could you have really allowed for the construction and the design of these very sophisticated machines like locomotives and manufacturing apparatus where you have subcontractors working on one aspect of a device that has to fit perfectly with another part of a device when they come together. You have to have paper. You have to have blueprints. You have to have which emerge around 1839 or so with the invention of photography. All of these are paper issues.
Yeah.
And what I love about paper, when we talk about the idea of it, it's always it's never on center stage. It's always out there in the margins. But when I look for it, in the arc of the narrative, I find it. And I find it in very significant and often very surprising ways.
Nicholas Bass-Baines is with us. His new book is called On Paper: The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. Earlier on the program, we gave the wrong day for Bass-Baines' appearance at the Utah Humanities Book Festival later this week. He's going to be at Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City on Wednesday night, not on Thursday. He's going to be reading from and signing his book. All of this is free and open to the public. We've got more details about it and the right date on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about paper with the writer Nicholas Bass-Baines. He's coming to Utah this week. He spent much of his career exploring books in all kinds of contexts. So, of course, it makes sense he would turn his attention to paper, the history part, the craft part. That's in the book. But really, he's mostly interested in the idea of paper as a medium and a message. The book is called On Paper: The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. He's going to be in Salt Lake City on Wednesday evening for a reading at Ken Sanders Rare Books. It's part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. I want to talk about the section you write about on Japan. Papermaking, of course, didn't originate there, but you say once it became established there, it kind of took on a life and a context of its own. And there's the chapter's really lovely about that part. And I wanted you to write about that. That kind of, you write that pristine paper is an expression of goodness and reverence in that culture.
It started that way 1,500 years or so ago. Paper is throughout Japanese life. I mean, plate glass, as we point out. I didn't even realize this before I started, but you didn't have conventional windows in Japan. Paper actually was a portal to the outside. They used these paper screens to divide rooms. I have a photograph in the book of this temple that is dedicated to the goddess of papermaking, yeah, who is said to have taught the Japanese the secrets of papermaking in the 6th century. Interestingly enough, in this particular village in Echizen City, mm-hmm, it's on the Japanese Sea, facing Korea, where papermaking is known to have made the crossing into Japan. It was Buddhist monks, actually, who used paper as a way of spreading the tenets of their faith. And the Japanese just embraced this, and it just became such an essential part of their life. The color of white and purity. I mean, mm-hmm, you find a word that serves both for paper and for God, whether that's coincidental or not, nobody has been able to say. Kami is the word, K-A-M-I. It was such an important place for me to visit, and not only to pay my respects at that temple devoted to the goddess of papermaking, but to spend a day, as I did, with a living national treasure, mm-hmm, papermaker, Ichibe Iwano the Ninth, who is the son of the first living national treasure papermaker, or the eighth, and whose son, at his passing, will become the tenth. And wow, to just spend a day with him was like a master class, to sit with him and to just go through these traditional techniques of hand papermaking. Let's be very clear that we're also talking about making paper by hand, sure, here in traditional methods. And it's a vanishingly It's a disappearing skill, and that's why it's been designated a living national treasure category, because I think there are fewer than 200 studios in Japan that continue to make paper in this manner. And this gentleman is considered to be one of the very, very best. And it was just such an honor to spend some time with him going over the steps and to have him articulate his thoughts and his feelings about what he was born to do and what he's passing on to his own son.
What's the takeaway? What did you get from him? Any new insights? Insights that you come back to?
Well, again, he didn't speak any English at all, so okay, things do tend to get lost in translation, but the traditional ways are the best, he said. My paper is the best because it comes closest to what the goddess taught. He makes no concessions to modernity. I mean, when I met he and his son, they were literally on their hands and knees in the water room going through the fiber of choice there is called kozo. It's the inner bark, the bast, the material that is scooped out of the inner bark of the branches of the paper mulberry tree, a cousin to the traditional mulberry tree. But this white fibrous material is scooped out and then is processed. And there they were on their hands and knees taking out these little specks and flecks of bark so you would have an absolutely pristine fiber that would then be beaten by hand into a pulp. You know, it's one of the many paper cliches that I have fun with in the book. You know, you beat something to a pulp or something's not worth the paper it's printed on. I have a whole chapter that's devoted to that. And then he goes and he makes this extraordinary paper that is so exquisite. I was fortunate enough to acquire a few sheets of this. And I'm thinking, I haven't done it yet, but actually framing just a sheet of this paper. Yeah. You know, generally, this is the medium for a work of art, but the paper, this particular paper, is an artwork in and of itself. It's magnificent material.
Let's go back to Da Vinci and the creative process that you write about. Of course, Da Vinci did not, you say, you mentioned all of those notebooks. He didn't really skimp, as you put it, when it came to recording his thoughts. He wrote on pretty much everything, I guess. You write about how his father sort of helped him get paper, or it was through
his father. His father was a notary.
Yeah. How prolific was he? I guess he was constantly writing stuff down.
Well, he had larger notebooks when he traveled, and he would make his own notebooks. He had, you know, what we might consider reporter's notebooks, the kinds of things you carry out into the field with you. He was constantly sketching. And as Martin Kemp, it was really an opportunity. I'm not a world authority on Leonardo da Vinci, but Martin Kemp is. Just as Robert Winter is the authority on Beethoven and Paul Israel is the authority on Thomas Edison. And I try to tell the stories of these creative geniuses through the eyes and the perceptions of three people who each have spent many decades just studying these particular individuals. And so it's really Martin Kemp telling me what he is able to derive from his study of Leonardo da Vinci and really how he follows his creative process, because it's not a linear sort of thing. I mean, he might be thinking of anatomy at some point on a sheet of paper, or maybe some ancient machine, an idea for a device will come to him, and he'll turn the paper around and work on that upside down. It's just an amazing association of thoughts that you can follow. And it is essential, he feels, to look at the actual sheets of paper, because you can see what came first. You can more or less examine the types of pencil or brushes that he was using, and just try and follow this association of thoughts through words and through images. And again, to repeat, what we know of Leonardo really comes to us by way of these notebooks, of which there are many thousands of surviving pages. It's really quite extraordinary that so much did survive, I think because they were recognized as brilliant in their own time. And he really didn't prepare these for publication. They were for himself, although in some instances he says, dear reader, so it could be that he thought at some point that they would find another audience. But he really did it for himself.
Yeah, Kemp describes it as reading Leonardo in the flesh, and he talks about
He said
a lot of us kind of think about it, and he talks about how there is a difference, he thinks, between, you know, because a lot of people have access to Da Vinci's notebooks, facsimiles of them, but he says that's a very different thing from actually, and he's one of those
few scholars who has access to the, or has anyway, had access to the actual notebooks of Da Vinci. But he says reading the actual piece of paper itself is different.
Well, you can see textures. I mean, Leonardo was a person who could draw in three dimensions on a flat surface.
Right.
You know, could he go to the fourth dimension? Well, he said probably not, you know. But he did a really splendid job of doing three-dimensional illustrations and images. And you can see, according to Kemp, you can actually see this when you feel this, when you handle the original documents, which very, very, very few scholars, even with the best of credentials, are allowed to do. He's been very privileged for a period of about 40 years or so to have been able to examine just about all of the extant notebooks.
I'll tell you the thing that I learned about Da Vinci, or at least I got a better sense of, was how he seemed to have when he was, and I guess we're all this way, when a thought comes to you, you feel this sense of urgency. And Kemp says when he sees the writing of Da Vinci, he sees this sense of urgency, he sees this sense of intensity. He says that with some of the paper, you get a sense that at the speed of which something
I love
is
it,
going,
Doug, that yeah. you're picking up on this, I have to tell you, because these are, to me, all 18 chapters of this book are like my children. I love them all equally. But when I get into this third part of the book, when we really enter the realms of the mind and the intellect, it really thrills me to discuss these sorts of perceptions that you get from handling these. You think of a piece of paper. It's in and of itself. It has no value. A piece of paper, I maintain, is the only manufactured product I can think of that gets value strictly by the intellectual construct that you place upon it. That's the chapter that I another chapter that I have face value, where I go from a $100 trillion Zimbabwean banknote,
right.
which I got online for maybe 50 cents and overpaid. But go all the way, then through the Weimar currency of the 1920s, and go all the way up to a single piece of paper that has a drawing on it, a Raphael drawing that sold for $48 million. I mean, is a piece of paper in and of itself worth $48 million? Is a Honus Wagner baseball chromolithographed piece of cardboard worth $2 million? Or a Superman comic book printed on acidic, terrible paper in 1938, which sold for 10 cents, the Nicolas Cage copy, which recently sold for $2.1 million, is it? 21 million times its newsstand price for what is really not very good paper when you come right down to it. But what is it that's put on there that we ascribe to it that gives it value? And not just monetary value. We think of personal value. A letter can be very precious to an individual. What would it command in the open market? It's irrelevant. But what does it mean to the individual? So paper has this power, and I think it's unique among manufactured products. You talk about precious jewels. That's a whole other category. But this is basically vegetable matter, beaten to a pulp, suspended in water, and passed through a screen, and then all of a sudden something of extraordinary significance is either drawn, written, or printed on it, and we give it this value. I just can think of no other object that has this power.
Do we know what Shakespeare may have been like as a note taker? It was said of him, you mentioned, Ben Jonson, his friend, said he never blotted out a single
Johnson
line.
Well, that was Jonson in the first folio, yeah. The story of Shakespeare, of course, is so fascinating because he really left no manuscripts to speak of.
Right.
There is a fragment in the British Library, an unfinished play, a play about Sir Thomas More. He is believed to have collaborated on it. So other than that, and eight or nine signatures, maybe not even eight or nine, six or seven, three of them on his will, we really have nothing that comes down to us in his hand. And this is why in one of the chapters, my title chapter, in fact, on paper, where I talk about 12 million extraordinary historical manuscripts in one library, the Massachusetts Historical Society, and then the first folios of Shakespeare at the Folger Shakespeare Library for printed books. But if it weren't for that printed book, for what we call the first folio of 1623, fully half of Shakespeare would be lost. But to get to your question, what do we know of his creative process? Really, not very much except for what we can read in his plays and what someone like Ben Jonson wrote in that tribute to him, which was published in the first folio, where he says he barely ever blotted a line. So whether he did or whether he didn't, we have to take Jonson at his word.
Yeah. What do we learn about Beethoven from the notes that were left?
Well, it's a similar story to Leonardo da Vinci because, when so much of his creative output was produced while he was clinically deaf, he was also an impulsive, compulsive note taker. Everything he did, he wrote down in a rush. He had ideas. He did improvisational things. And there are several thousand of these sketchbook leaves. And they are spread all over the world in collections. And there's a scholar, and one scholar in particular, but with two others, worked for the better part of 25 years examining every one of them and what could they tell about Beethoven's creative process by examining these sketchbooks. And he did a similar kind of thing. He made his own notebooks out of sheets of paper. Some were large that he carried with him. Every time he moved, and he moved often, he had trunks of material that he carried with him. Didn't date them, which made it difficult, but also made it fun, according to the scholars. So you try and date the compositions by the kind of paper you know that he was using at that time, what kind of pencils he might have been using. So they have been able to try and put together a census of his work through the examination of his sketchbooks. So it's comparable. I thought that I would look at three great creative spirits. In different media, you have Leonardo, then you have music, you have Beethoven, and then Thomas Edison, more to our time, 3,500 of his notebooks. And the two illustrations that I like to use is the one of the light bulb, which uses as its filament a piece of carbonized paper, by the way, that was the first successful use of a light bulb. They later went to another material. And the phonograph, which used a form of wax paper, paraffin paper, as a recording surface. But everything he did began with that spark of thought, of non-verbalized thought that he rushed down to sketch out. Very crudely, you look at it and you say, well, gee, there isn't much there by the way of directions. But right, first of all, what he's doing is capsulizing these thoughts, getting it down in a rough state before you proceed to the more precise manifestations of it. So I focused on those three individuals in that one chapter.
Nicholas Bazbains is with us. His new book is called On Paper, The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. On Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, Bazbains is going to be giving a reading at the Ken Sanders Ware Bookshop in Salt Lake City. That event is part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. It's free. It's open to the public. We've got all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Nicholas Bazbains. We're talking about his book, On Paper, The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. He's going to be in Salt Lake City on Wednesday evening for a reading at Ken Sanders Ware Books. It's part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. I want to read an email we got from Ryan in Salt Lake City. He writes, I have a degree in painting and drawing, yet I don't use paper anymore to draw. Computer programs like Photoshop have changed how I express myself, changed the very conduits to which I receive and see ideas. Basically, he writes, I became impatient with paper and pencil because I needed to discover the happy accidents quicker in order to find imagery that excited me. It's an odd feeling, though, he says, because I used to draw dinosaurs as a kid and would fantasize about having an endless supply of paper to use. And Ryan's comment, Nicholas Bazbains, sort of gets to a crucial question. What happens in the digital era now when we don't have to necessarily go to paper to write something down quickly? What's the future of paper? How are you thinking about that?
Well, I'm thinking very deeply about it. And as far as the listener's creative process goes, if it works for him, fabulous. I'm not a Luddite when it comes to paper. But what does really concern me is that for the first time in human history, and writing goes back 5,000 years, you know, we can go back to the Sumerians in Mesopotamia where they recorded their writings on baked clay tablets, which still survive. But for the first time, we now need a mechanical interface of some sort. We need a very sophisticated machine. We need software. Are you confident, am I confident, that 100 years from now, that material that is born digital, that is not preserved in any kind of material way, is going to be around, not only to be preserved, but to be accessible, to be readable in any kind of meaningful way? I think of the 12-inch discs and the 5-inch discs and the punched cards and the magnetic tapes that were used for the Viking space missions that are lost entirely. Yeah. And this is within the last 30 or 40 years. Am I really confident that the work that you're working so hard to really visualize your creative process and you're setting it down in a medium that nobody can be really certain is going to be around? Never mind 100 years from now. How about 200 years from now? I have held in my hands, it's been one of the great moments of my life, but I held a Gutenberg Bible when I was writing A Gentle Madness. Now, this book was printed in the 1450s. It's the property of William Scheide. It's at Princeton University. To pick up this book, I actually was lightheaded. I thought I was going to faint. You know, wow. In fact, you hear this elderly gentleman saying, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Forgive me, I'm a little lightheaded." But to hold something in your hands is more than a half a millennium old. It looks as good today as I'm sure it did when it was printed. It's on paper. All you really need to access this is a facility to read Latin or German, you know, as the case may be. It's in Latin in this case of the Bible. Do I need more than a language to access something that's born digital? I do. I need a machine that I'm confident is going to work, a software that's not going to be superannuated 10 years from now and preserved on a medium that's not going to degrade. So that concerns me, to answer your question.
When a story,
and I don't think it's because of any great nostalgia for the paper book, which I do prefer, I have to say. I have yet to read an electronic book for the pure pleasure of it. I still prefer reading books in the old-fashioned way.
You quote an historian, Jesse Shera, who said, "The paper."
It's a great quote.
"The paperless society is about as probable as the paperless bathroom," which sort of gives you the sense that paper is about supreme practicality. There's a utilitarian
function.
Right,
it's not
right.
Sexy. It's but it's very functional. Its utility is there. It is there to serve us, and which was another of the reasons that it was so attractive to me as a subject. It's there, as I said earlier. It's not on center stage. It's off in the margins, but it's there serving you, but in very functional and practical ways. And as Jesse Shera said, you know, and I do have a chapter in the book that certainly does deal with the hygienic issue. Just read it, you know, one and done is the name of the chapter.
Right. But what about, I think what's interesting, though, is what happens, you know, not having the actual paper to scribble on? The thing I kept thinking about was, what was it for Edison? What was it for Beethoven? What was it for Da Vinci? What did that do?
But what did the paper do?
Let me finish the question. So,
okay, I'm sorry.
What I'm wondering about is what was going on when Edison was actually doing the scribbling, the actual tactile art of using his hand to make that expression, or Da Vinci for that matter. And what happens when you now can you accomplish that same process by doing something on an iPad, for example, or something digital?
Well, you tell me. I'm one of these people that really solves problems in my sleep. You know, I can go to bed really perplexed about writing something or looking for the right word. It can be a word. It can be a concept. But maybe solving it, I don't know how, but waking up and feeling the need to write it down instantly, to capture it before I lose it, a thought, a turn of phrase or whatever. For me, that process works best with paper. I'm not about to get up and run downstairs to my fire up my computer and try and write this thing down. The thought will be lost. Having said that, I do all of my writing on a word processor. I don't sit down with a notepad. However, I do print out, and then I do all of my revisions with pen on paper. So I think it's a different process for a different individual. For me and for so many other writers and other creative people, I think that, you know, the facility of the paper is just an essential aspect of the process.
The section you write about in the book over the identity that we get from paper, how it forms.
We are what our papers say we are, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And you write about Antonio. Tony Mendez, of course, is the figure in... People know the figure from the film Argo, Operation Argo, you write about, this CIA operation in Iran.
A little coup for me to actually have been able to interview him, you know, 3 or 4 years before Ben Affleck had any idea who he was.
Well, you write about this, what the stuff that Mendez kept looking through or exploring anyway, this idea that the CIA calls it pocket litter, this idea
pocket litter.
These little things in paper that give us our identity. Say something about that.
Well, it's pocket litter. It's what they also call a legend. And this was not a unique case, getting those six diplomats out of Tehran. There's another famous story, Operation Mincemeat, I think it was called, during World War II, when the Brits basically concocted. They got a dead person and dressed him up as a Royal Marine and just outfitted him with all kinds of paper objects. Conjured up an airplane crash in the Mediterranean with the hopes. Actually, what they did do is release his body from a submarine off the coast of a Spanish town. But he would float ashore with all of this, not just a letter that would have the Germans believe that the first invasion of Europe would be taking place here as opposed to there, but the other stuff that gave him life, you know, a pass to the officers' club, some paper stubs to a play, a letter from his fiance, a receipt from a jeweler, you know, for a ring that he would have bought for all of the stuff that we typically have that gives us our individual. I mean, look, open your wallet sometime and just look at what's in there beyond your, you know, your driver's license and your credit cards. I mean, the various cards that give you an affiliation, how much you can tell of an individual just by the paperwork that they carry around with them. And that's the sort of thing that these people in the intelligence services do use to create characters. And in fact, when they first established the forerunner of the CIA, the very first thing that they got was a printing press. Yeah. And I write about that. You know, they said before you can do any of these things, you have to have the ability to make these documents, very persuasive documents, beyond the passport and the ID card, but also the other little things that give an individual character, and so that was kind of the thrust of that particular chapter.
I want to ask you about the last section in the book. You come around to the events on
I get goosebumps even when we start to approach it. To be honest,
well,
with you.
I have to say that the imagery really that comes to mind is what some witnesses called the paper rain that came down when the buildings collapsed. Talk about why you ended the book with that.
You know, I. Most of my books begin with an image, and I won't go through them, but if it's Gentle Madness, it's riding through the frozen cornfields of Iowa with a notorious book thief. In this particular instance, one of the very first images I had, and even before I knew I was going to be writing a book about paper, was the sight of those enormous two buildings in New York on 9/11, crumbling, thundering to the ground, but with these geysers of paper just spewing out of each one of them. The only artifacts, by the way, of any significance to survive that horrific attack on the United States was paper. Mm. You might have a twisted fire extinguisher somewhere or a horribly twisted fire truck or a chair, the remnant of a chair. But really, the only artifacts that survived was paper. Why that is? I mean, paper was raining down, as you say, and it was accumulating. It was hip deep in places. So I thought, you know, when I started to not only for the power of that particular image, but what can we say about the world? You know, certainly the world that we inhabit in the first full year of the third millennium of the 21st century. These two iconic buildings, and we're looking, and all of this paper is raining to the ground, not only in the immediate area of Ground Zero, but across the Hudson River on one side, across the East River on the other. Were there people out there gathering, archiving some of this paper that was, and what can we tell from that? Mm-hmm. And in much of the structure of the rest of the book, it can go from the purely mundane to the extraordinarily significant. And I think I give you a couple of examples towards the very end of that chapter and into the epilogue, where you have some, you know, heretofore untold stories, but a business card that comes to rest on a Brooklyn windowsill. It has the name of Pablo Ortiz on it. Who is Pablo? Pablo Ortiz, and he, Pablo Ortiz, was working for the World Trade Center Authority. He is cited for having easily saved 50, perhaps as many as 100 individuals, of helping them escape and leave the building. He perished, and then later that night, a singed business card bearing his name is found on a windowsill. And then, most profoundly and powerfully and poignantly of all, is a note, mm-hmm. 84th floor, west side, 12 people trapped, no name signed, picked up on the street minutes before the South Tower collapses. A woman picks it up and hands it over to a guard for the Federal Reserve. He looks up, and before anything can be done, the building crumbles, it falls. It's a piece of common bond paper. I was actually going to call this book at one point Common Bond. Hmm. It became on paper. But still, here's a very plain piece of paper that I describe in the book really retains its final message for more than 10 years. Without giving too much away, there are those words on the piece of paper, but there's also a smudge. There's a blood stain. And were we able to actually to find out who wrote that letter more than 10 years after the fact? And that's how I conclude the book. I thought one piece of paper really speaking volumes for all the billions upon billions of pieces of paper that have served so many functions nobly and just out of pure function. But it seemed an appropriate way for me to more or less wrap up the book.
Nicholas Bass-Baines. This book is called On Paper, The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. He's going to be in Salt Lake City on Wednesday evening for a reading at Ken Sanders Rare Books. It's part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. You can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. Nicholas Bass-Baines, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It's been a great interview. I've enjoyed it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music is composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond as well. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.